Right. So we're coming to Gimel Tammuz, which is going to be this Shabbos. The day the Rebbe passed away in 1994. Now, when the previous Rebbe passed away, which was in 1950, he had issued a discourse to be studied on the day that he passed away. And his successor, his son-in-law and successor, who is our Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, focused very strongly on that last discourse, that last teaching. You see, a Hasidic Rebbe in Chabad Lubavitch, his primary function is, if you can put it in such simplistic terms, to say discourses, to say mamarim, to say Torah teachings of a particular kind. And these Torah teachings are very spiritual. They're very intense spiritual teachings. It is said about the second Lubavitch Rebbe, so we're going back to like 1800, when he was a young man. He was born in 1773. He got married when he was 17, 18, something like that. And he was offered two different possible shidduchim, two different possible girls to marry. And he said, well, which one could get married earlier? So they said, you know, this one, for whatever reason. You know, maybe she lived nearer, whatever the reason was. So he said, well, I prefer to marry the one. In those days, in that kind of family, they didn't sort of meet the person and discuss with them the way they do today. Today in Lubavitch, when two people want to get married, it's suggested that two people maybe would get on with each other. So they go out and they discuss and they talk, what's your view on this and how do you like that, and is she lively, is he this, is he that, you know, like, and they finally work it out. But outside Lubavitch, there's some Hasidic groups where they meet for a very, very short time, you know, maybe an hour or 2 hours, and maybe there are still some groups where they don't actually meet at all, and it's all done by the parents. But so he wanted to marry the one that was most quickly able to get married. So they said to him, "Why do you want to marry? What's your hurry to get married so quickly?" He said, "At the wedding, my father will say a discourse, a Hasidic discourse. I'm longing to hear what that discourse is." You know, so that's the idea of a Hasidic discourse. It's something intense and beautiful and magnetic. And a Hasidic Rebbe in Lubavitch, that's what he does. He says discourses. Now, there are other things he might do as well. He might be a tremendous organizer. He might be he might work miracles. You know, women come and they've been married for 10 years and they haven't had a baby, and the Rebbe gives a bracha and the next year they had a baby. Or as happened to someone living in London, a husband and wife, they came to the Rebbe and they said they want a bracha for a child. They hadn't had a baby yet. And the Rebbe said, "I thought I gave you a bracha already." I did give you a bracha already, but if you like, I'll give you another bracha. So she had twins. So a year later, she had twins. So that's, and I know, you know, the, I know. So that's the thing of a Rebbe might give brachas and all kinds of other things, but the essential thing about a Rebbe was saying mamorim. And every single Chabad Rebbe said mamorim, which fill many, many, many books. That's many books by the first Chabad Rebbe, the second Chabad Rebbe, and so on, all the way down to our Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe. So given the fact that the seventh Rebbe, our Rebbe, was so focused on the last Maimer, which was said by his predecessor, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. And when Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak passed away, and our Rebbe focused on his last discourse and said a lot of Torah teachings about it itself. So then we come to our Rebbe's discourses, and to understand in which sense this is the last discourse of our Rebbe. Because our Rebbe would say discourses, and also edit them for publication. It was like two stages. And sometimes the edited discourse is quite different in many ways from the discourse that he said. Now, how did this work? To be at a Hasidic gathering with the Lubavitcher Rebbe was an amazing event. Absolutely beautiful event. I saw, when I was just in New York, I saw a very, very beautiful framed large photograph of a Hasidic gathering with the Rebbe. Absolutely beautiful photograph, very expensive, $2,000. It was a photo taken by a very famous photographer, an art photographer. And he'd come to 770 and took a beautiful photo. But I think here in the hall, there is also, on the left-hand wall as you go out, there is a picture of a gathering with the Rebbe. It's in black and white, I think. And you see there a whole crowd of people, and the Rebbe is facing them and is speaking. Now, when it came before the discourse, the Maimer, the Rebbe would say to the, you see, there were people who were standing close to the Rebbe throughout the Hasidic gathering, called the Verbrengen. Throughout this gathering, who were able to remember every single word the Rebbe said. That was a remarkable feat. They were so focused on the Rebbe's style of thought that they would absorb, and also brilliant minds, and themselves very, very well versed in the teachings of the type that the Rebbe was speaking about. All these hundreds of books of teachings that by the previous six Chabad Rebbes. And so they were able to hear very, very clearly what the Rebbe was saying and remember it. So on Shabbos or a festival, when the Rebbe spoke, they could just remember 6 hours of talks interspersed with melodies, or 4 hours. It was very, very remarkable event. And after that, a remarkable mental power. And after that, after the after Shabbat, when Shabbat went out, they would gather together and they would go through every single talk the Rebbe said, and he said it like this and like that, and then they would write it all down after Shabbos, and it became a transcript of the talks of the Rebbe and also of the discourse. You see, the talks and the discourse are two different things. The talks, the Rebbe would explain a piece of Talmud, Chumash with Rashi's commentary, giving a brilliant analysis of something in Rashi no one had ever noticed before, this insight. Or he might speak about issues such as the woman's role in Judaism, or something to do with the land of Israel and the holiness of the land of Israel, or some issue in halachic terms, which is an issue of the moment, which was necessary to warn people about. Various things at various times. So he was communicating like a teacher. But then when it came to the discourse, the maimer, it was something different. So the signal for the maimer, as I understand it, was the Rebbe would say quietly to one of the people nearby, the Maimer Nigun, sing the melody of the Maimer. And they would, and then everyone would start singing the melody of the Maimer. It was always the same melody. And that had tremendous significance. Now, when you heard this melody beginning, everyone became, it was like you were trying to prepare yourself for a spiritual experience. And what happened in 770 is that everyone would get up, while for the rest of the Hasidic gathering, for the different talks about Rashi, about the land of Israel, about the role of the woman, about some halachic issue, some people would be standing up, usually the yeshiva students, and older people would be sitting down, like in pews, like in a shul. For the maimer, everyone would stand up. And when the Rebbe then said the maimer, when he began saying the maimer, it was a completely different atmosphere. He wasn't saying it like he's explaining to you a complicated idea and he's drawing an example from here and comparing it with that. It was just flowing through him. It was an absolutely remarkable experience to hear this and see it. It's as if it was flowing through the Rebbe. And there's an old Hasidic saying drawn from the Midrash about Moshe Rabbeinu. It says about Moses, Shechina medaberes mitoich groinoi shel Moshe. The Shechina, the Divine Presence, spoke through the throat of Moses. And at the very beginning of the Hasidic movement, people said this about the great Hasidic leaders, such as the ancestor of the Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who was the first Chabad Rebbe, and the Rebbe is his descendant, his great-great-great-great-grandson, and successor as well. And other Hasidic leaders as well, and that for in those first two or three generations of Hasidism, that's what people said about a Hasidic leader. When he spoke, you could feel the intensity of the Divine Presence speaking through it. And so it went down through the generations, and certainly in the Chabad school, they preserved this very strongly, this spiritual sense of contact with the divine through the teaching of the Rebbe. And then, so the Rebbe would say a maimon, and the team of people who are able to remember what he said and would then write it down after Shabbat or the festival or whenever it was, they would write it down and they would prepare a transcript of it. Now, so those transcripts were sort of, they were always called an unofficial transcript, and they were published eventually in books, and basically they were typed out, and you could get it as a kind of a typed page, a book that was all typed. That's how it began, and then later they got more organized with the printing. But sometimes they would edit one of these transcripts and put in footnotes and things like that, and the Rebbe might instruct them to put in an extra paragraph taken from a different discourse on this concept or in that concept, and it would be a discourse that was edited for publication, and then the Rebbe would very, very carefully go through it, and this became his printed statement. So the process of editing is like the final statement by the Rebbe. Now this discourse that you have in front of you was originally said in 1981, which is 13 years before the Rebbe passed away. But in 1992, 11 years later, he edited this discourse, and it was called Kuntres Purim Kotan, when there are two Adars in a year, not this year, but previous years, other years, when there's 2 months of Adar, so Purim falls on the 14th of Adar, but of the second Adar, so that Purim and Pesach are always 1 month apart, because Pesach comes 1 month after the after Purim. But then the first Adar, the 14th of the first Adar, is called Little Purim. So it's got a certain festive atmosphere. Not like the real Purim, but a certain quality of something special. And the Rebbe put this out, he edited this discourse and explained it, and it was given out it was printed and given out for the 14th of the first Adar. And then 13 days later, or the 27th of Adar, the Rebbe had a stroke. And so, really, this was the last discourse that he edited. And so, in that sense, this is his final discourse. And 2 years after having the stroke, he passed away. So this was really his last formal teaching. Now, what is in this formal teaching? Now, it was on the verse, we're looking here at the beginning of the Sedra Tetzaveh. Tetzaveh is an interesting Sedra in the Torah, because it's a Sedra where Moses' name does not appear. That's a very interesting thing, because from the book beginning of the book of Exodus, the whole Torah, the Torah is full of mentioning Moses. God said this to Moses in the first Sedra of the book of Exodus, Moses is born. And from then on, it's all about what Moses said and what God said to Moses to tell the people, and what Moses did and what the people said to Moses. It's all about Moses. In this Sedra, Moses' name does not appear. And that's very interesting, that the final discourse of the Rebbe should be about a Sedra where Moses himself does not appear. You know, it's as if the Rebbe is writing something for us, which we're going to take with us to a time where you don't see the Rebbe. Yes, where the Rebbe is not actually there physically. You know, so that's the way people understand this, this idea that it's on a Sedra where Moses' name does not appear. However, what this discourse explains is the function of Moses. Suddenly, it's a theme which comes up a few times in the Rebbe's teachings, but it's not there all the time by any means. This discourse is about the nature of a Rebbe. What is a Rebbe? You see, Moses is the paradigm, is the image of what a Rebbe is supposed to be. And all the future leaders of the Jewish people, the great rabbis, they're seen as some version of Moses. They are an expression of something of the nature of Moses spreading out through the generations. The sages talk about the spreading forth of Moses through the generations. So here, this discourse focuses on the function of Moses. What is it that Moses does? So let's try and explore this together. We're looking at the very first paragraph. We're going to go through a little bit by bit. Va'ato tetzaveh. Do you see those words? Va'ato and you, tetzaveh, command, es b'nei Yisrael, the Jewish people. This is what it says in this Sedra. Ve'yikho elecho, and they should bring to you shemen zayis, zoch, pure olive oil. And it goes on talking about the bringing of the oil, which is going to be put in the menorah, and the menorah will shine, the seven-branch menorah will shine with this oil. So a number of questions are asked about this in the first paragraph that we're not going to read inside. But the main question is, what does it mean, you? You means Moses. You, Moses, will command the Jewish people. What does it mean, you will command the Jewish people? Moses doesn't command the Jewish people. It's God who commands. God commands the Jewish people, and Moses passes the command on to them. God says, you should bring pure olive oil for the lamp, And Moses tells the people, this is what God wants, that you should bring pure olive oil for the lamb. Moses doesn't make up the command comes from God. So then he answers this at the beginning of the second paragraph. So now let's move to the second paragraph. Look at the second line. The explanation is, just after the brackets, you got two words in brackets, and then the tzivui. The word tzivui, command, that we've been translating as command, tetzave, has another meaning as well. Hutzavta v'chibur. It means a bond and a connection. The same word, we see this in English, can have several different meanings. Even though it's the same word, it can mean other things. So there's a word in Hebrew which means command, but the same word or similar word in Aramaic doesn't mean command, it means connection. It means a bond. V'zehu, and that's what it's saying, v'ata tetzaves b'nei Yisrael, you, Moses, have to connect the Jewish people. Shemoisha, this is in the third line, Shemoisha hu makasha, Moses binds, umachaber, and joins, es b'nei Yisrael, the children of Israel, that means the Jewish people, im or ein sof, with the radiance of the infinite. That's what Moses does. Moses connects the Jewish people with God. Now that's an amazing thing. So now we understand, what does it mean in the Sedra? You command the Jewish people. It's not you command the Jewish people. You connect the Jewish people with God. So the first thing we understand is that the function of Moses, the function of a Rebbe, the function of a Hasidic and spiritual leader, is to join the Jewish people with God. Now, to understand that, let's go on to the next page, which is page Kuf Lamed. Everything's in Hebrew here, even the page numbers. So the next page, which is on the back of this one, due to our... Right? It says Kuf Lamed at the top, and we're looking in paragraph Gimel. Ulevai is there, and to explain that, Magdim Ba'maimah, it begins explaining... Shemoshe Rabbeinu Nikra Raya Mehemna. Moses, our teacher, is called Raya Mehemna. Now, Raya Mehemna means literally faithful shepherd. Do you have it, Rini?
No, I don't know where
I've got limited. Here. Yeah. Shemoshe Rabbeinu Nikra Raya Mehemna. Right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Moses is called the faithful shepherd. The Shnei Pirushim Bezeh. And there are two ways of explaining what does it mean, faithful shepherd. The first explanation is Shuhu Roye Neman Shel Yisrael. He is the faithful shepherd of the Jewish people. In other words, he's the faithful leader of the Jewish people. Like a shepherd, whether it's rain or storm or hail or hot sun, the shepherd's there looking after the sheep. So, a good leader of the Jewish people, or of any group of people, a good, real, dedicated leader, he is the one who is, whatever the difficulties, you know he's going to be there, yes? The captain is the last one to leave the sinking ship, yes? He doesn't jump into the lifeboat and leave everyone else stranded in the ship. He's the one, he waits on the ship till everyone has gone into the lifeboats for freedom, and then just as the ship is really sinking, he jumps out, hopefully, and is saved. So the leader is the one who takes responsibility. That's one way of understanding faithful shepherd. But another way of understanding it, Ushuhuzon, he feeds, Umafanes, he supplies, Es Yisrael, the Jewish people, Be'inyan Emunah, with faith. See, faithful shepherd can mean he is a shepherd who is faithful, responsible. Or it can mean he pastures. Pasturing really means like feeding the sheep. You take the sheep to a grassy hill and the sheep eat the grass. So that's the job of the shepherd. Then when they've eaten all the grass over here or it's not so comfortable here. He moves them to another patch, and they feed over there. So the second meaning is that the leader, the true Jewish leader, sorry, like Moses, pastures the Jewish people with faith. Now, then comes the question. Why does he have to do this? Why do we need a leader? Excuse me. Why do we need a leader in order to strengthen our faith in God? We're talking about faith in God. Why do we need a leader, a rabbi, a rebbe, a Hasidic teacher, in order to strengthen our faith in God? Now it says there, we're on the third line, second word in. Because the faith which the Jewish people have got mitzad atzmon, which they have on their own account, this is how the Talmud describes the Jewish people. They are believers, the children of believers. In other words, the Jewish people have a strong belief. By nature, the Jewish people are supposed to have a strong belief in God. That's why they still exist, because they've got this strong belief in God. And whatever the terrible things that have happened in their history, they're still true to God. So that's wonderful. So if they have this deep faith in God, why do they need a Hasidic Rebbe, a Moses of our time, in order to strengthen their belief in God? They've already got belief in God. The problem is, next line, fourth line, that natural belief that the Jewish people have, Efshe Shetiyeh Bevchinas Makif, it's possible that that belief will be just in a surrounding form. It won't be internal. It'll be surrounding. Now, what does it mean, a surrounding belief? The Talmud tells us that a thief, when he's trying to steal, he's broken into a house, God forbid, he's found a window open in the middle of the night, and he's climbed into the house, and he's now looking, and he's found a drawer, and he opens the drawer. There's a string of pearls in the drawer. Wonderful. And suddenly, he hears outside, it's a police car. And he thinks, God, don't let them come for me. And then the police car goes, he goes on driving, thank you, God. You know. So this thief, he's praying to God, he's thanking God. So this is what the Talmud says. The thief who's engaged in stealing, he might well, just he's a thief, doesn't mean he doesn't believe in God. In our own time, you've got, very religious figures, you know, the mafia or something, they wouldn't dream of not going to church, but they would kill people. So he believes that God is helping him stealing. Now, isn't that ridiculous? God says in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. How can he possibly steal and imagine that God is that he prays to God to help him steal? It's an absolute ridiculous thing to say. But he's able to do that, and many people do this in different ways. Yes, not necessarily stealing, but other things which aren't appropriate. He does it because his faith in God is what's called a surrounding faith. We could call it a superficial faith. It doesn't fully express this term. But it's a faith which doesn't enter his heart, that if you believe in God and you have to be a consistent person, and God says don't steal and don't do this and don't do that, so you're not going to do it. That's a consistent person. That's a person whose faith is internalized, is within their heart and becomes part of their way of thinking about life. But for many people, they believe in God, and they even fulfill mitzvahs, many mitzvahs, it seems, and they look like very religious people, could be, and they're very concerned about, you know, Shabbat and Kashrut and modesty and other rules. But there's certain things where they indulge themselves in one way or the other, in an inappropriate way, in a way they shouldn't behave like that. And that's because their faith is something which surrounds them instead of being inside them. And what it explains over here is that the role of Moshe, the role of Moses in the past and in the present, the role of a Rebbe, of a Hasidic Rebbe, is to help a person internalize their faith in God so that they really live according to their faith. And the simplest way, it doesn't say this in the discourse, but the simplest way that you can imagine this process is whoever it is sees the Rebbe, and what you see about the Rebbe is that the Rebbe believes in God. You see very clearly the way in which the Rebbe is completely... I remember the first time I saw the Rebbe in 1973, and I went to 770. I traveled from here to New York, and I went to 770, and a friend of mine here had explained to me exactly how it works on a Friday night, where the Rebbe stands, and where... And so there I was in shul, watching the Rebbe daven. And it were on Friday night and on Shabbos morning. And one thing that was very, very tangible was the way davening to the Rebbe was an absolute reality. He was talking to God. You could feel that very strongly. It was an absolute reality. And if you see someone for whom God is a total reality, it rubs off on you. And God becomes a bit of a reality for you as well. Yes, okay, a religious person tries to live with God as a reality all the time. But if every religious person, so-called religious person, like all the people living here in Stamford Hill, they're all very religious and they wouldn't dream of eating anything not kosher or something like that. But if God were a reality, there are things would be a bit better. Yes, in various ways. And the fact is that there are people for whom God is a reality at this moment and not at that moment. That God is a reality in their lives, but not at every moment. And what the Rebbe helps you achieve or strive towards is that God should be a reality every moment of life. And that's what it means. Well, we can only just touch on what this discourse is about, but this is the central theme of the discourse. And so we have explored something of this final teaching of the Rebbe. And the thing is that he then goes on and explains that what a person wants when they are really dedicated to God is that they want godliness to be revealed. You realize that this is what God desires. God wants to be revealed in the world. And the way in which God will be revealed in the world, in the whole world, will be through the coming of Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, when the Messiah comes, God will be revealed to every human being in the world. And the man or woman who is inspired by this yearns for Mashiach.
Yes, but there are people who believe the Messiah is already here. Not in the Jewish religion, but they fervently believe that the Messiah has come.
The test of...
But the world isn't perfect, though.
The test of whether or not a person believes the Messiah has come is how they behave. The people who were running the Spanish Inquisition, torturing people in the most horrific way, which has all been recorded by them in Latin. And I knew scholars in the Hebrew University who knew Latin, and they would read these accounts, these shocking accounts of torturing people. So that's not much of a Messiah if it leads you to torture people.
No, I don't think so.
The idea of the Messiah is to make you love people. And indeed, we're supposed to live in such a way as if the Messiah has come, as if the Messiah is about to come, and we express that by love of other people. And so people, unfortunately, who claimed that the Messiah had come and then wanted to kill everyone who didn't believe that, that isn't any expression. That's not what the Messiah is about. The Messiah isn't about killing people who don't believe in the Messiah. That's a false concept of what the Messiah is all about. Those people began off as Jews, and then it died out among the Jews, and it became a non-Jewish system, which it's quite understandable. It became part of Roman life, with the Romans liked killing people. And so there was an excuse. Here's a, you know, one way of killing people is that this person's a slave, so it'll be fun to see him eaten by a bear, as they used to do in a Roman amphitheater. Then there's another good reason to kill people, because they don't believe in that the Messiah has come, so let's kill them for that. Yeah, so it's a lust to kill, you know, kill people for this reason, kill people for that reason. The Jews, the lust of the Jews is not to kill. The lust of the Jews is to bring life and goodness and wholesomeness. And especially if they learn Torah and they see the meaning of Torah, the desire is, and the guidance of the Rebbe, is that there shouldn't be one little spot in the world where anyone doesn't feel the revelation of God. God should be revealed everywhere. And it used to be thought that a person could separate himself from everyone else. This is actually in a later paragraph. We'll just have a little look at this, and then that will be the last, because it's... this is on page Kuf Lamed Hei. If you look at the top, it's Kuf Lamed Hei, and it begins with Inyan. I'll find it for you. Here we are. This one.
Oh, thank you.
And you've got it. And you've got it. Lovely. Have you both got it? Have you got it?
Kuf Lamed Hei.
One second. Yeah, that's two pages later. Right here.
Very good.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, go in. Okay, now. Now, the point is, the Rebbe is here talking about yearning for Mashiach. There were times when what the Jewish people are trying to do is keep Judaism. And they were yearning to be able to keep Judaism because there was terrible oppression, like in Spain in the time of the Inquisition, and like in communist Russia and other places. The Jew couldn't freely have a Shabbos meal with candles burning on the table and having wine for Kiddush, because there were all kinds of oppressors who wanted to destroy that. But we live in a very comfortable time, thank God. In most places in the world, anyone who wants is able to make a Shabbos atmosphere and daven or build a shul or basically do what they like. Right? We live in a very free, we've never been as free before. So is that the whole thing? Just to be comfortable and have all the Jewish books that we need? No, there's more. The more is that we want godliness to be revealed in the whole world. It's not enough that it's just revealed in your home because you're keeping Shabbos, and in your home because you're keeping Shabbos and Kashrus and everything. That's beautiful. But it has to be in the whole world. That's the goal. That's what the whole Torah is about. That godliness should be revealed everywhere. Va'inyan hu, and so the concept is as follows. The fact that the Jewish people feel broken, from the fact that they're in exile, even when they have luxury, both physically and spiritually. Thank God, most Jewish people are not starving. They have a home to live in. Sometimes it's more, sometimes less. Sometimes they live in a little apartment. Sometimes they live in a big house. But they have a home. That's physically. They may even have a car. And then you have spiritually. They have books. Now people have an ordinary home here in Stamford Hill has more books on their bookshelf than many Rabbonim had 200 years ago. Because it wasn't easy to get books. Books were expensive. And rare, comparatively rare. And now books, thank God, they're printed by the thousand, and everyone, people build up beautiful collections of books. And if they're not satisfied with the physical books, they can have them on a hard disk. I've got a hard disk at home with 30,000 books on it. So just in case there's a run out of books on the bookshelf and need one, which is more difficult to get hold of. So spiritually, and they learn these books, they study these books, where we're surrounded by yeshivas, kollelim, people studying Torah, girls are studying Torah. So spiritually, there's a wonderful revelation of God, you'd say. But the point is, ki ritzoino hamiti, middle of the second line, the true desire, shel kol echad mi Yisrael, of every single Jew, is that godliness should be revealed. Va'ad shezeh, until this, the gilu elokus, the revelation of God, noigeh le'etzem mitziyus, affects the very essence of the Jewish person. V'lechein, and therefore, zeh shebizman ha'golus ein me'a gilu elokus, the fact that at the time of exile, there doesn't shine this revelation of God, k'mo shehoyah bizman ha'bayis, as it was in the time of the temple. You see, in the time of the temple, godliness was revealed much more. And the fact that we haven't got that, miss out the brackets, hinei mizeh atzmoy, from this itself, he goes into Yiddish, is ein ganzen zu treisel, the person is completely shattered inside. Kosis, ground up. Now, there used to be a way of thinking at the beginning of the Hasidic movement, that Hasidism, which focuses so much on the spiritual and the holy dimension of Judaism, that if you look at Judaism in the Hasidic way, and you don't only pray thinking about the meaning of the words, you think deeper, and when you fulfill a mitzvah, you have a deeper sense of what the mitzvah is all about, it's so inspiring that you could imagine a person, this was a way of defining what a Hasidic Rebbe was. A Hasidic Rebbe is a person for whom the Messiah has come. A Hasidic Rebbe is someone who is living in such a spiritual state that it's as if the temple is there and Hashem is revealed. And in a way, that's what it is. That's why I said before, that seeing the way the Lubavitcher Rebbe daven, you could feel that for him, God is absolutely apparent. So that's, now, how does such a person think about him himself in relation to everyone else? That's what he talks about here. V'gam k'shehu b'daga nalis yoseh. Even if this person is on a very exalted level, Shemeya etzlo gil elokus, that godliness is revealed for him, bedugmas hagilui shahoya bezman abayis, similar to the way godliness was revealed in the time of the temple, mikol mokom, nonetheless, mizeh shebichlalus ha'olam, from the fact that in the world as a whole, ein meya hagilui, the revelation doesn't shine, muchoch, that proves, Shegama Gilu Shemeh Etzlo, even that aspect of revelation that shines to him, Hu Gilu Mugbal, is a limited revelation. He can think, yes, godliness shines to me. Hard luck about that other person living around the corner who doesn't keep Shabbos. Obviously, godliness doesn't shine to him in the way it should through Torah and Mitzvahs. Well, you know, that's what a pity. That person is deluding himself. The level of godliness revealed to him is itself limited. Because if godliness were revealed to him in an unlimited way, then that godliness would be revealed everywhere. The Keshameya Gilu Ayin Sof HaBligvul, because when the radiance of the infinite, which is unlimited, shines, HaGilui Hu B'chol Mokom, then it shines everywhere. O Keshiyesh Mokom Echad, and if there's one single place, Afilu Pina Nidachas, even a remote corner of the world, She'ein Me'ya Shom Gilu Elokus, and godliness doesn't shine there, Humipnesha Hagilui, is because that revelation there in the heart of the great person, Hu Gilu Mugbal, is limited. And then he goes on to say, quoting from Vezeo Masha Muva B'Maima Admo Azokin, and that's why the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe who wrote Tanya, he says, the Issa B'Tikunim, it says in the Zohar, Shafilu im hoya tzaddik echad, if there was one tzaddik, choyze b'tshuva shlema, who did complete tshuva, in other words, came completely close to God, b'doiroi hoya bo Mashiach, in his generation, Mashiach would have come. Because through his complete tshuva, he would have drawn down the infinite radiance of God. Now that is what the Lubavitcher Rebbe yearned for. He yearned for Mashiach. And he transmitted that yearning to his followers, the Lubavitch Hasidim. And to the extent that people are able to feel this yearning in a true and a genuine way, and a way which lifts up and connects everyone that they meet, try to connect everyone to Hashem, this is really our task, to respond to the leadership of the Rebbe, the inspiration of the Rebbe, to feel close to God, to internalize everything that God says to us in Torah and Mitzvot, and really to try. It's like there's a hill, you know, like a hump in the road. You can't get over that hill. Sometimes if you're driving a very old car, so you can't go up the hill. The hill is too steep. And so it can appear to a person that to keep this extra mitzvah, it's just too difficult for me. I can't do it. All my life I behave in a certain way or worn a certain kind of clothes. You don't expect me to change. And then you go, oh, you manage to go over the hump and you're able to do it. And that is internalizing what Torah mitzvahs are all about. And at a deeper level, is this longing for Mashiach to come, so that every Jew in the world, and ultimately every human being, will feel that closeness to Hashem, that closeness to God, and that will be expressed through the building of the temple in Jerusalem, and the world recognizing that that is what has to happen, and the Palestinians and everyone else saying, yes, yes, this is what has to be, the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, which will bring peace and harmony and goodness to everyone in the world.
Thank you.